there. This is Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. It's a podcast about making things up and making things happen. I love talking to creative people about what they do. Today, my guest is Abdi Nazemian. He is an author. His books include Only This Beautiful Moment, which recently won a big Stonewall Award, and also Like a Love Story. They're in the young adult category, but I've read them both, and at least I'm halfway through the second one, and they speak to me so profoundly. I think they're so beautiful, and I was so excited to talk to him. Also, we met at a party, and he was wearing a Madonna shirt, and we started talking about that, and we both have, you know, a long history with Madonna, and I had just seen the concert this week, so I was like, I'm going to have him on after I see the concert, and we'll talk all about it. So, long story short, this is going to be a two-part episode. But before we get to part one of that, I want to remind you that this podcast, Dennis Anyone, is brought to you by me. I do it because I love it, but there are ways you can support it. You can go to DennisAnyone.net and leave a tip in my virtual tip jar. Also, you can become a subscriber to DNR Studios. I'm part of a group of shows under the Derek and Romaine banner, really fun shows. And for a monthly fee, you get my show early and all these other great shows as well. I also want to mention one of my side businesses, Lifecast by Dennis Hensley. That is where I interview people about their lives like a podcast, put music into it, edit it, like have these cool sections, and it becomes like an audio heirloom. And I found out this week, when I first launched the business a few years ago, a lot of my first clients were parents of my friends. So a friend's parent would be getting up there in age and they'd be like, I want to get my parents' story down for posterity. You know, I want to hear where they went to school and how they fell in love, their whole story. So I would go and interview their parents and edit it together. And this week I found out that one of the people that I had interviewed had passed on. The first person, I think, that I interviewed for this business that has passed on. And the son just wanted to let me know how grateful he and his siblings were that they have that story down, that they have the life cast with their mother. They got to hear her voice. And it's not even just the story. Sometimes it's just hearing their voice. Sometimes in these interviews, people will do things like sing the lullaby that they used to sing their kids when they were growing up. Anyway, I was really heartened to know that what we created together meant so much to them and that they have it. They got it while they could get it. So if that's something you think you would like for someone in your life, go to getalifecast.com and we'll make it happen. And back in the day, I used to only do in person, but now with Zoom and technology, I can do it over Zoom. So getalifecast.com is where to learn more about that. All right, that's enough for the plugs. Here now is part one of my interview with the novelist Abdi Nazemian. Joining me now from Los Angeles, it's Abdi Nazemian. He's an author, and his books include Only This Beautiful Moment, Like a Love Story, The Walk-in Closet, The Authentics. He's also worked in film and television. He was a producer on Call Me by Your Name. And you've worked on other projects as well, The Artist's Wife, your screenwriter, The Quiet. You've done a lot of cool stuff. But the reason we're talking is because we bonded over a Madonna t-shirt you were wearing at a party. So first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Yes, Madonna connects us all.
Madonna connects us all. And I met you at a writer's mixer and you had a Madonna shirt on and I started talking to you. And the next thing you know, we were off to the races. And
yeah, it was wonderful.
I have a lot of Madonna in my past. She was instrumental in my career trajectory. So we started talking about Madonna. It turns out you are a super fan and that she is very significant in your novel, Like a Love Story. So that was the first one I read after we met. Actually, I listened to the audio, which is brilliantly done, and fell in love with your work. So I'm so happy we're doing this podcast.
I am so happy. So, so happy. I obviously want to talk about my books. I want to talk about Madonna even more.
Well, my notes are to talk about the concert first because we waited until I saw the concert The Celebration Tour to talk about this. How many times have you seen it?
The Celebration Tour?
Yeah.
Only once, and I think it will be only once.
You think it will be only once? And you did not see it in LA. You saw it somewhere else.
So we luckily happened, my family lives in New York, and we brought our kids there in December. So just before Christmas, it happened to line up with her dates in Brooklyn at Barclays. And our kids love Madonna.
How old are your kids?
They're 12-year-old twins, boy and girl. They've been raised with Madonna. We've been dancing to her music forever. And we really wanted this to be their first big concert. And for context, my parents took me to the Virgin Tour when I was 8 years old and then to Blonde Ambition when I was 13. So it's almost like this family tradition. Madonna really has connected my whole family. And it was a beautiful experience to take them and a very expensive one. And because of that, I doubt I will go again.
Right. But I went the first night in LA a couple of nights ago today when we're recording this. But I'm seeing all the posts from every other night. And I was kind of like, oh, I want to go again. And I want to get a different seat and see a different vantage point. And anyway,
I know I was in Chicago speaking at a school. You know, a beautiful thing about being a young adult author is you get to speak at schools often. And I was there speaking it to three different groups of students. And it was when Madonna was there. And I kept telling myself, if I can get a great seat under a certain price right. that I had for myself, and I kept refreshing StubHub, refreshing, thinking like something will come or the prices will drop, and they didn't. And so I stayed in my hotel room. And
there it is. There it is. I found the concert very emotional. I was very emotional in it.
That's the big surprise of it, right, is the emotion. I tell everyone, I feel like what she gives up with the fact that she's aging and she can't dance the way she used to, she adds to the show with vulnerability.
Yes.
And it's beautiful.
She talks more than she ever has. You feel like she's more honest. Yes. You feel like yes, a lot of the walls have come down.
When she said nothing, she used to just be like, hello, Los Angeles, and right. that's all you get.
Yeah, she talks, and her voice sounds different. Like, it feels like all of the affectation that would happen to her voice sometimes if she was living in London or whatever, and not that it was calculated, but her vocal, she just sounds like a real person talking now. Did you notice that?
I did. I mean, it's, you know, the thing about Madonna and her shows is for so long, I feel like they were so precise. And that was some of what made them so special. But I think what's amazing about this show is there's these long segments where she just rambles.
Yeah.
And she kind of just says stuff, and you can feel her making it up as she goes along, and that's really new. I mean, there was some of that, I guess, at the Madame X tour, you know, but I feel like she's allowing herself to be more off the cuff, more vulnerable, more herself.
Yeah.
And it's special.
I saw somebody post, like, I like this part, I like this part, and the parts I didn't like were any parts where she talked. And I was like,
oh, I saw that same post.
And I was like, you don't understand shit. I was infuriated. And also, we're like,
quite have that response.
It just incensed me. I was like, that's the gold, I thought.
You know, I think this is the kind of thing where, and you think about somebody like Madonna putting on a tour like this, a celebration tour, singing her greatest hits, she has to balance out what the true fans like us want with what, you know, the general.
The dabblers.
Or people who aren't even there because they want to be people who are there because they went with friends or they went with work colleagues or they got tickets for free. I mean, you don't know.
Yeah.
And I think she did that masterfully in this show. Like in classic Madonna style, she sang the majority of the big hits, but she reinvented them her way. She also included songs that I was shocked made the set list.
Like?
And like Bad Girl.
Yeah. I love it.
Like Mother and Father.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. And American Life is my favorite album. I mean, that's a deep cut. Opening with Nothing Really Matters, which is really a forgotten song.
Was it even a single?
It was a single, but it didn't do very well.
Right.
And it's, to me, a brilliant opener, given what it says.
Right.
And
what it's about is really powerful.
Yeah. But come on. I mean, nobody would have expected that.
You mentioned Bad Girl. Her daughter, Mercy, plays the piano on that. Her kids are really good at stuff. They're really good.
Her kids are really good at stuff. Our kids, who, as I said, were 12, were especially moved by her kids being there. They really loved that. That was really amazing to see. Her kids also seem to love her.
Yeah.
You know, reading like interviews with Lola, who now is like an amazing young woman, it's so fascinating to get a peek into how much they seem to genuinely love their mom. And I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily think that.
Right. We did not think that she had that mothering thing in her in the way
even
that,
though she's our mother.
Even though she's our mother. Like, no, we were all like, I remember Sandra Bernhard once saying about Lola, oh, when she's older, she's going to she's going to dish, or, you know, like there was a book coming or something like that, which is not the case. Have you seen Rocco's artwork?
I have, of course.
He's really good. Like, and Mercy's piano, they like, they're really Mercy's excellent. Really good.
David is probably the true star. I mean, he just shines on stage. Mercy's an incredible pianist.
Yeah.
Esther, the one doing the voguing, right, is some kind of unstoppable force. Yeah, it's amazing. And you think, look, like, I don't know her personally. I don't even know if I want to know her personally. I think it's so special to have someone that you just look up to in this way. But she's an incredible human being. And I would imagine she has raised those kids, teaching them what she's learned about the world along the way, about survival, about passion, about how to live correctly, because she's now been doing this for decades with so much grit and staying true to who she is. And that's amazing. I mean,
it was amazing.
Else can say that?
I'm going to probably get emotional talking about this.
But well, like, we haven't even talked about Live to Tell. So
Live to Tell is a song that she uses to pay tribute to everyone that was lost to AIDS, so many of them in our own life. And it comes at the end of a segment where it's a party and holiday, and somebody just keels over and dies at the end of holiday. And then it's Live to Tell. And she doesn't talk. There's no title cards that say, we just know. And then the faces start appearing up. Herberts. Yeah.
I believe it starts with the faces that were closest to her. It's Martin Burgoyne airing her Brits, and then it kind of builds out from there. And she worked very closely with the AIDS Memorial, which everyone should be following on Instagram, to collect those photos and to do it right. And I mean, to me, the whole sequence that, like you said, it begins with Holiday, which is this incredible celebration. I love the moment where it's mixed with Chic's I Want Your Love. I thought that was so cool.
That choreography really pops.
The choreography pops. She's so alive, and you sense who she was in the 80s coming back, this kind of, like, you know, passionate, rebellious young woman who's embedded in the gay community. And then, like you said, someone dies. She starts singing the melody to Holiday, but in this really sad, haunting way. And then it's Live to Tell. And then you go into Like a Prayer, which is another one of my favorite numbers. And I thought that whole sequence, those three songs, were one of her best live moments. She just really told a little mini story about her and us and our community. And she did it beautifully. When you read Like a Love Story, I think you get a hint of this, but I've said this for a long time. I always listen to Live to Tell as a song told from the perspective of a gay man in the 80s dealing with AIDS.
Wow.
That was the song. It obviously wasn't what people thought the song was about, but if you listen to it,
it wasn't about the plot of At Close Range starring Sean Penn.
I mean, did she see that movie?
I haven't thought about that. That movie was even a thing until just this second. But yeah.
I know. But listen to the song thinking about what she was going through. Thinking about what she was going through when she wrote it and those lyrics. And it's, you know, man can tell a thousand lies. To me, it was always about this, like, gay man living in the closet who's dying and realizing he may never get to tell his story.
Yeah.
And then he is, like, honoring all these people who are lost. It's so beautiful. It's just, it's stunning. It's stunning. Everybody was in tears.
Well, and the faces keep coming, you know. There's Gabriel from her Blonde Ambition tour dancer, Michael Perea, who I used to want to be a dancer and was kind of did some dancing. I auditioned for her tour. I think we talked about this. But like, who was on the Virgin tour, the tambourine. I'm like, oh, that guy.
Right.
Like the faces. And then, you know, it starts with a few big faces and then just this mass. And other people have done that. Other places have sort of tried to capture the volume and that overwhelm. But there was something so artful about the way this tour was put together. Like, I saw Renaissance, Beyonce. I'm a fan of Taylor Swift. I didn't get to go to Eras, but I watched the movie. There was an elegance to Madonna's set and staging. And there was something, a sophistication, a maturity. I don't know. There was something about it that I thought separated it from other recent tours that we've seen, just in terms of how the stage was designed and the different elements. I just thought it was really elegant.
Yeah. Well, it was she's a storyteller. I mean, I saw the Beyoncé tour and I absolutely loved it. And I think, you know, those tours are in conversation with each other. They're both a part of Madonna's in the Beyoncé tour and Beyoncé's in the Madonna tour because of their Queens reunion, which I thought was very cool. But, you know, I think with Madonna, anybody who sees that show is going to understand it's a version of her life story. I would imagine all the work she did on the biopic is found, some of it found its way into the narrative that she tells here. And, you know, when she does live to tell, it's a reminder that she was there. You know, she was there. She lost her best friends, her mentor, all the whole community. And she's honoring them in the way she knows how through this medium. I mean, she is a real master of telling a story through a concert.
Right. And she was there for us in a way that not a lot of people were at that time.
Always. Yeah. Always. Yeah. And truly back then, I mean, I was so young. I was, you know, very sheltered, came from a culturally conservative community. You know, I'm Iranian. I was an immigrant. I was not somebody who was exposed to, you know, celebratory gay imagery or to all I knew about being gay was AIDS because it's all that the media would talk about. And I was afraid. And it wasn't until Madonna really started to be vocal about it that I learned anything outside of fear and shame and stigma. She was the only one.
And she would put things in her album notes, like safe sex practices and things like that.
Absolutely like a trip. That's how I found out about safe sex.
What did your parents think when they're taking you to Madonna as a kid? Were they like, he likes this singer? Well,
there's a scene in my book, Like a Love Story, where the mother, you know, the character of Reza, who's very much based on me and is obsessed with Madonna and in the closet, you know, finally comes out and he says, how could you not know I'm obsessed with Madonna? And she says, I thought you had a crush on Madonna. And he's like, no, I wanted to be Madonna. I mean, I don't know if that's verbatim what happens in the book, but that's pretty much what happened in my life where my mom said that, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, there was a part of them that probably thought I was just in love with Madonna the way anyone would be in love with a, you know, beautiful, desirable woman. They didn't come from a culture that had gay icons, you know, in that way. So they didn't understand that. But I do think it's an important point because we're in this really weird moment of like cultural conservatism again, where books like mine are being banned all over the place. I mean, like a Love Story is banned almost in so many states at this point. It's crazy. And, you know, my parents were very conservative when I was growing up. They were culturally conservative. They were conservative in terms of how they voted and who they supported. And yet they never policed art. You know, they took me to the Virgin Tour. They took me to Blonde Ambition, which was so gay. They bought me the sex book in high school.
Wow. You know, did it fall apart or did it hold together?
It fell apart, but it also made me very popular because I went to boarding school and when people found out that I had that book, they all visited me. I swear, owning that book changed my life.
That's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, again, I go back, like what happened? Like back then you could be like my parents and who had conservative values and also say, you know what? We're not going to stop our kid from exploring the things he needs to explore. It wasn't this thing that people that's happening now where everybody wants to police what people read and watch and see is just, it's wild to me.
Yeah. Everything's become tribal.
Yes. But no, my parents, you know, my favorite story I tell about my parents who have come quite a long way and, you know, are not conservative anymore, but is that they took me to Virgin Tour and Blonde Ambition. And I think both shows kind of shocked them at the time. But many, many years later, they went to the Rebel Heart Tour on their own without me. And that just said it all. I was like, yes.
You got them in. You got them hooked.
I got them in. I know. They
I love it. Another part of the show that really moved me is she sang Express Yourself with guitar, acoustic.
Not to me. She didn't.
She sang a different song to you. What did she sing?
I Will Survive.
Yeah.
Which, to be honest, I loved.
Yeah. Well, she talks about coming through that health scare and that – how serious it was. And she went on a bit on Monday night when I was there. I don't know how much she talked about with your group, but I think one of her doctors was in the audience and she talked about how, you know, when she was trying to recover and she was so impatient and how she wanted to come back for her fans and her kids were so excited about the tour. And somebody said, when do you think you can do it? And she's like, 2 months. She just picked a number out of the sky and did it.
Do you remember where you were when you heard she was in the hospital? That was like...
I don't remember. Where were you?
I was in Provincetown, and I remember it so well. We went for a week in P-Town, and I met this amazing photographer named Michelle Shapiro, who I think took the photo that I sent, that you asked me for a photo of myself. For
yeah.
And Michelle came up to me in a bookstore. I was browsing a bookstore and came up to me and said that she had read Like a Love Story and loved it and asked if she could photograph me on the beach.
Oh, how cool.
And so we made like a date on the beach to take that photograph that I sent you. And we've remained friends. But the day that we took the photo, I had like heard the news right when I was going there. And so I arrived just telling Michelle, I'm like, I know you read the book, so you understand that I am in total crisis right now. Because the news first broke, it seemed very scary. Like I was beside myself. And
yeah, I think the word unresponsive.
Yes, the word unresponsive.
Yeah.
And everybody, I was in Provincetown, which for those who don't know is, of course, a gay, you know, gay Mecca.
Yeah.
And it was all anyone would talk about for 2 days until we got news that she was, you know, going to be okay. But it was really special. And I feel like in a weird way, I look at that photo now, which I use often as a promotional photo. And I always remember that emotion that we were all feeling.
Right. And also the way that you came to meet that photographer.
Yeah.
I got so emotional during Express Yourself because she had everyone turn on their phone lights. There was something about the purity of her voice and the message.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could cry. I'm crying right now thinking about it.
I could feel your emotion now. I know. I really felt that during Live to Tell, and that whole sequence, like I said, is where I felt the most emotion. And I also felt, nobody talks about it enough, but the mother and father segment was so stunning to me because, you know, for those who aren't going to get to see the show, she sings that song in front of this giant photograph of her mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always felt like it's interesting. I feel like there's so many different kinds of Madonna fans, and I'm definitely one who gravitates to like the darker sides of her. And I really feel like the underlying thing that connects so much of her art is grief and loss. It's the loss of her mother at a young age, and it's the loss of her whole community to AIDS. You just feel it in so much of what it does. And that's why I think she makes such great dance music too, is because there's a sense that she's dancing through something. It's not just frivolous. Like to me, there's much like disposable pop music that I'm not interested in. Like with Madonna, you feel that she's worked through something. She's earned the right to dance. And to see this moment, I mean, it's so moving to have her standing in front of her mother. And then I think at a point, there's a photograph, her son David plays the guitar during that song. And then there's a photo of his mother. It's obviously Madonna's his adoptive mother, his birth mother. It's just so beautiful. I thought that was so moving. She really leans into vulnerability in moments in this show.
Yeah. In our show, she talked about how draining the show was for her. She sort of acknowledged it. She goes, not physically, it's the emotional stuff, because I really am taking you through my life. And another section where I really felt that was all of the sexual sections, that the thing that sort of turns into this giant orgy. And she's very Fever is in there, Erotica.
Erotica, Justify My Love.
And then at the end, she sort of gets pulled away and hauled off almost like by rough, you know, manhandled almost like by police. And then I'm Not Sorry, Human Nature plays. And I was like, you know, I'm almost as in awe of what she said about sexuality generally than I am about her connection to the gay community, just across the board. And there's a segment in your book, Like a Love Story, that resonates with this idea. And I found it incredibly enlightening because you connected two dots in my head that I hadn't really connected before, even though it's kind of obvious once you hear it. So talk to me a little bit about, there's this note card theme that recurs in Like a Love Story. Tell a little bit about the plot of it and then talk about how the note cards figure in. And then I might have you read the note card about Madonna.
So the plot of Like a Love Story is, it's a story about three teenagers in New York City in 1989 and 1990 over one school year. And it's three POV, so you get to hear from each of them. The story kind of starts when Reza, who's an Iranian closeted teenager, moves to New York City with his mom. And he meets Judy and Art. And Art is the school's only out kid. He's like an activist at heart who's full of fire. And Judy is an ally who also has an uncle who's like her favorite human who is living with HIV and an ACT UP activist. And so through them, Reza kind of discovers the queer community, discovers himself, and the book touches on ACT UP. There's a lot of their actions are a part of the book. I did a lot of research on that. And Reza also, as I did, becomes very obsessed with Madonna and kind of like she helps in his journey of liberation. And the note cards that you mentioned, those are something that Uncle Steven writes to the kids, particularly to Art as a young queer person. And they're all, it's like they're numbered note cards on queer icons, queer language, queer concepts. It's everything from Madonna to Elizabeth Taylor to love to high school. And those kind of came about when I first started writing the book. They weren't even note cards. They were almost like rants. And I realized like, wait, I have to find a way to fit these into the narrative. And I love this idea that Uncle Steven was doing this for a young person because, you know, as young queer people, especially back then in the 80s and 90s, we didn't have mentors. Like it wasn't something that, you know, I came from a heterosexual family, heterosexual world. At that point, I was living in the suburbs. Nobody was telling me about gay language, gay concepts. I mean, I didn't even know Madonna was a gay icon, to be honest. I know I said my parents didn't, but I didn't either. I've always been fascinated by this idea that like we find these icons. Like I became obsessed with Judy Garland and Joan Crawford and Rita Hayworth when I was 10. Like how? Why? You right. know, I didn't know. Nobody told me. They were all like gay icons. So it's a little bit of that. I think with Uncle Steven, it's showing the importance of mentorship, the importance of young LGBTQ plus people having mentors. I think it's such an important thing to talk to families and young people about. Like if your kid comes out, seek out mentors for them, seek out a community that they can see themselves in.
Sorry.
What's happening? Are you crying?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I love that your emotions are so present, like on the surface. That's so good. I envy you that.
I think it's something about the age I'm at and, you know, where I'm at in my life. I think I felt that. I felt not only that, like, Madonna was there going, look, I'm still here.
Yeah.
I thought that. Yeah, I thought that as well. Sometimes when I have these moments, I cut them up a little and they're not as bad to listen to as they are to watch.
No, I hope you keep it. I hope you keep it because, you know, honestly, I was somebody who was raised very much to like keep my emotions hidden. And I think I'm still too good at that. And I tend to put them all into my books. You know, it's much harder. Like you got to put beaches to get me to cry. You got to like, I need
well, your book, I cried all kinds of places in your book. I'm very raw right now and not because things are bad. It's a mix. It's like I have an appreciation for the journey and also then where I'm at and what's next. And it's a raw time. And
but that's a beautiful thing. I feel that too. You know, it's funny. You talk about this need for mentors. Like when I wrote Uncle Steven, Like a Love Story is the first of my books that really did well. I'm a very honest writer. Like I'll tell you when things I did didn't work. And like my first two books they set me up for what is now my career as an author, but not a lot of people read them or connected to them. You know, Like a Love Story, when I wrote it, I thought would just be another book that disappears. And it wasn't. It did quite well. And it still gets so many readers. I get so many notes about it. It's, you know, I have people writing to me that it taught them so much or connected them to their family, that it, you know, opened up conversations they couldn't have. And what I've realized through the journey of writing this book and the ones that have come since is like, in this strange way, I've become the Uncle Steven to some other people. And that's such an emotional thing. Like now I go speak at schools and I talk to teenagers who don't have a lot of, in communities where they don't have queer mentors or adults. I'm telling them about their history. I'm the older person. Yeah. I'm writing about being young, but I'm actually like turning into the mentor figure I wish I had. And that's a really wild, emotional, amazing thing that if I were someone who could just cry, I would cry too right now thinking about it.
I'll cry for both of us. I had a feeling, the same kind of feeling I had at the end of the movie Barbie, where like, oh, they said everything they wanted to say and they got away with it. Like, I kind of, you got ACT UP in there, you got sex stuff in there, you got like gay history in there. Like, I was like, it's like you kind of said, I'm going to go for broke and maybe they'll publish it. Like, I didn't, well, I'm going to soft pedal this part or whatever. It really felt like you were going for it.
I did, and I didn't. I mean, part of the reason I was going for broke is because I didn't think anyone would read it, to be honest. And so there was no fear. And also at that point, I mean, I wrote like a love story when I had been a professional writer for, I think, 12 years. And it was 12 years of like most of the stuff that had my name on it that was made, especially in film and TV, bore no relation to my values. Like, there was no queer life, Iranian life. It didn't reflect who I am. And I remember, like, especially when my kids were born, because, you know, a lot of my better writing happened once they were born. I started to feel like, my God, I don't want my kids to grow up and someday Google the stuff I've written and be like, oh, that's who our dad was. Like, I want to write something that tells them what my heart is and what my values are. And so much of that, I mean, I did go for broke in this book. And probably that's why it's being banned, because all that stuff is in there and people are scared of the real emotions that come with talking about our history and gay life. And you can't, you know, you can't write a book about HIV and AIDS and not talk about sex.
Right.
You can't. One of my favorite scenes in the book is when Stephen and Jimmy, there's kind of two mentor figures in the book, Stephen and his best friend Jimmy, who are both ACT UP members, and they take Reza and Art aside and they give them like the birds and the bees talk, but for gay men.
Yeah.
You know, and I never got that. Like, I had to learn about sex from a leaflet and Like a Prayer and from, you know, sneaking porn out of places. Dude, nobody would talk to us about sex. It was just like, if you have sex, you'll die. That was it.
That was it.
That was sex set.
Or there's the fantasy that you did have it and it was hot and everything went perfectly. And so I like that your characters are like, I don't even know what to do. Is this stuff going to work? Like, it was very, what position? And like they were talking about sort of like the nuts and bolts of it in a way that was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this right. Or they were scared about it, not just because of AIDS, although that's a huge part of it. But just like, you know,
it's so already scary.
Yeah, it's already scary. And so many times in culture, it goes off without a hitch and they cut to the after thing. And that was great. And they're having the cigarette. Was it? I don't know. I appreciated how frank it was around that stuff. And I want to talk about like the young adult book world and what you can do and what you can and how that all came to be. But we were talking about the note cards and I would love for you to read the Madonna note card from the book. So these are notes that the mentor character, Stephen, put on cards for Art and other young people, sort of like, you know, gay culture for dummies flashcards or something. You know, like they're like,
that's
these
exactly what they are.
Right. I don't mean that they're dumb, but they're that sort of like, here, this is what you need to know. Like, get up to speed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the Madonna note card that is part of this alphabetized.
Which is number 76, because I did do, even though there's only a few note cards in the book that made it, I did alphabetize a whole spreadsheet on Excel with every single note card, what it would have been, and Madonna ended up as 76 alphabetically.
I feel like that's a merch opportunity right there. Do the cards.
That is really good.
I know a place that can print playing cards because I did it for some other thing, a game.
You're so good. I'm not like merch-minded. Okay. I need to be a better like brander, salesperson.
All right. Okay. So this is the note card.
76 Madonna. She is not ashamed, and therein lies her massive power, because shame is their weapon. People who feel shame remain hidden, and that's exactly how they want us. And then along comes Madonna. She was quickly written off as a flash in the pan, a one-hit wonder, but not by the people who recognized immediately that she was not just a singer, not just a dancer, not just a performer. She was and is a revolution. Just look at the way she responded when Playboy and Penthouse ran nude photos that were taken of her when she was young and broke. She said three words, I'm not ashamed. Those words are why her presence in the world gives me hope for the future, that more queer kids will come out sooner, that more women will feel the freedom to own their sexualities, that maybe someday shame will be something kids don't feel anymore. Before I became sick, I was out with Jose one night on a dance floor. Madonna came out and sang one song, Holiday. No one had heard of her yet. But within seconds, we were communing with each other, with her, and with a new way of thinking. You can turn this world around, she sang, and she meant it. To turn the world around is to create a revolution, isn't it? She is a revolution in every sense, a radical change and a celestial body in orbit. She's turning this world around and showing us how to follow in her footsteps. I don't know if shame has a true opposite, perhaps pride, but that doesn't feel quite right. So as far as I'm concerned, the opposite of shame is Madonna. Long may she live.
For those of you keeping score at home, I cried through about 65% of that thing. What was that like to write? Did it come out? Did it pour out, or did it take a lot of thought?
No, it poured out. This book and most of my books, I'm a very like instinctive writer who doesn't plot out my books. I tend to just write them, and if they, oh God, I'm going to sound, I know I sound a little like I'm so LA, but if it feels like the voices are speaking to me, yeah, then I keep writing. And if it feels like I'm forcing the voices, I tend to stop. You know, I'll abandon books like 100 pages in if it feels like it doesn't want to be written by me. But like A Love Story, I remember I do a lot of my first drafts in London. It's just a city that inspires me. And I remember going there and just writing. I mean, I think I wrote like 200 pages in 2 weeks. They were very rough. I mean, they were rewritten and rewritten and rewritten.
Right.
But you know, stuff like that just came. Most of the note cards were, I want to say, like 10 times as long. I mean, the note cards were long. And my editor was like, I love the note cards, but they got to be, how could he have even fit these on an index card?
It's got to fit on a card,
In the book, it was supposed to be on an index card. She's like, how exactly did he fit these 10-page diatribes on index cards? No, it was, you know, it's like you said, I think a lot of stuff that I had hidden, I was in the closet for a long time. I didn't come out to my parents till I was 24. I spent the first half of my career as a writer in Hollywood hoping I could tell gay stories, but for the most part not. And often being told, I mean, the first studio job I had, the notes that came back said, cut every gay character. I mean, we, you know, you probably know, I know you're a writer.
When we were coming up, the idea that you could write a book like this at all, let alone in a young adult kind of category, that just seems like a miracle to me.
Yeah, of course it was. And by the way, it wasn't controversial to get a note from a studio that was cut every gay character. It was like, oh, okay, I guess that's what we have to do to get our paycheck. Like,
you know, when I have a book called Misadventures in the 213, and there was a couple of TV possibilities that happened, and we, you know, deals were made and all this stuff. And at one point they were like, let's make the gay guy and the friend brother and sister. Like that, like there was all this talk of like, how can we navigate this? And I remember the 90s, maybe you'll relate to this. I as a gay writer, I think there was a lot of us turning ourselves into knots going, well, we'll make the gay character a teenage witch, and then we'll channel it through her, all our feelings. Like, we felt like we had to game the system. And then I watched – somebody had a copy, an early advanced copy or something, of The British Queer as Folk, Russell T. Davies. And I watched that
– I got an advanced copy, too. I remember that so well.
And I watched that with my jaw on the floor, and I thought, oh, we can just tell the truth.
Yeah.
And it was like an epiphany to me. And I don't know if I always did that in my work, but I think we came up in a time when we thought we had to be sneaky.
Yeah. We had to be sneaky. We had to hide.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 100%.
And so your book, reading your book is like, it felt miraculous to me.
It feels miraculous to me. Even reading that segment, it's, you know, I am somebody who learned very early how, to your point, how to mask certain things, how to be presentable to the outside world, how to kind of like hide my pain and the things that people didn't want to see. And I feel like I've put it all into my books, and they're actually well received. And I genuinely think that's a testament to this new generation. You know, the reason that books like these are doing well is because young readers demanded them. I mean, young readers led the young adult industry into stories like these.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that. But I want to say one other thing about the note card. Shame is a word you hear more now in the last 5-10 years. Brené Brown talked about it. It wasn't really a word that people used or thought about. And I never connected it to Madonna until I read your card. But of course.
Is that true, though? Because when I think about Madonna and I think about like Well, you know, I often have this conversation with Madonna fans about like, what are her signature songs? Because what's fascinating about Madonna is she doesn't have a signature song like so many artists. You could argue for many songs.
Oh, yeah, 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 for sure.
But when I think of like a lyric that truly encapsulates her, I think of Burning Up, where she says, I'm not the same, I have no shame. And that to me was, I remember, and there's something about that video, like so early in her career, it is so in your face. She's telling you in that very early part of her career, like, I am not like everyone else. Yeah. Like, you're not going to shame me. I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. And nothing you think of me is going to stop me. Like, yeah. What an empowering attitude in that Reagan era of.
Yeah, I guess I think what I think of is like, we were seeing it on her, but the idea that that could be us as well. We don't have to feel ashamed either. And how much of us feel that all the time in some way. That conversation feels a little more recent, though. She was way ahead of the curve. I think I'm saying that I never connected Madonna with the idea of carrying shame around or not.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I think, and I talk about this quite a bit, and I'll talk about it more when my next book comes out in September called Desert Echoes, which is largely inspired by my first boyfriend, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But I genuinely think there is a lingering epidemic of shame in our community.
Comes
from the HIV and AIDS era of gay men of our generation who did not think they would grow old, who did not know and weren't given the tools and have ended their lives. I mean, we have way too many friends who are not with us anymore. It's shocking. I mean, if I told you the number, I'm sure it's the same for you. Like the number of suicides, overdoses in our community, it's just, it makes me so sad because I think that shame is hard to shake off, you know?
Yeah, it's a real thing. And reading it the way you put it, I thought was so powerful. And it is, for me, the stuff around the sexuality in her concert was almost as powerful as any other part. Like, because I think my attitudes around sex generally were, I was raised Mormon. So between that AIDS, like sex was, the idea that sex could be fun, beautiful, sporty, like that you it's just a part of being a person. You know, like sport fucking, like those ideas were things that I was a little looked down my nose. I thought were wrong, or like I was a little uptight around it. And I didn't kind of go, oh, people should do whatever they want. And, and I didn't get there until my 50s. And in a way, I feel like, oh, I blew that. I don't know. If I could live my life over, I would try to think differently about sexuality for sure.
Yeah. I know you probably know this, but you still have a lot of life left to live and you're still a vibrant person.
Thank you.
Who happens to be part of a community that seems to really love older gentlemen.
So it's not too late. Well, that's a bit of like what I was feeling at that concert is, because I said this to my friend that was there. I was like, look at this, because the crowd was interesting as too. And it's like, oh, look at all these people who used to be a lot sexier than they are now. Because we're all of a certain age, like that you could still kind of see the swagger, but we're all a little older. I found that poignant. I found it sort of moving. I found the whole thing really moving in ways I can't quite articulate.
I know. You know what? It's so funny. I was ready to give you a counterpoint and tell you like, oh, you know what? Like so many of us are sexier now and blah, blah, blah. And maybe we are. And I'm certainly more confident in my body now, but I don't want to give a counterpoint because I often feel the same way.
The kind of outfits that people wearing and pulling off and like,
I know,
you know,
but I think in a deeper sense, what we're really talking about is the fact that our generation did not get to explore sexuality freely in the years where our bodies were most sexual and young. And I often think about that. And I talk to many of the gay men of my generation about it. Like I spent the vast majority of my teens and 20s celibate, you know, I just was afraid.
Long stretches in my life for sure.
Yeah.
And you look back at pictures and you're like, oh, I was cute.
I know. And I thought, you know what? I thought I was so unattractive. And another thing that happened, and this is something we have talked about in the gay community too, is I remember in that era feeling very unattractive as an Iranian in the gay community. Like I felt like the only people anyone wanted were like very white, very like WeHo kinds of guys.
There was a clone. There was a look that was like that era.
Nobody looked at me. And it's not like now I feel like I actually feel like I'm an attractive person. I look back at photos of myself. I'm like, my God, why did I feel that way for so much of my youth? Yeah. Like anytime someone was attracted to me, it was shocking to me. Yeah. Like, and I should never have felt that way. And, you know, but.
And I think what's moving to me about Madonna is that she understood all of that.
She is so smart and so in tune with humanity. I mean, you have to be an artist of her caliber for so long. And I really do think, you know, we talk about musicians, we talk, you know, people compare. I'm so over like whatever's happening in the culture where everyone's like pitting these artists against each other. It's so boring. But to me, Madonna's not even like she's a true artist who understands the human soul and reflects it back. And if she's upset people for 40 years, it's because the things she reflects are often uncomfortable for people. And she sees it. I think she saw us before many of us saw ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think her sort of resilience, like I can keep going. And if I can keep going, you can keep going. You know?
It's so inspiring. I mean, when I was in Provincetown and got that news about her being in the hospital unresponsive, that was so much of what was going through my head is I don't know who I'm going to be without her inspiring me to keep going. I mean, she is the one. Like when I'm going to a big meeting that scares me for some job I want, I blast Madonna. She is the one that inspires me and has shown me that when the world kicks you down, you just got to get back up.
You just got to get, you know, she says the most controversial thing I've ever done is stick around. I think that's really so profound.
True. The most perfect thing she's ever said. Yes.
I want to talk to you about the world of young adult novels. Cause when I was growing up, it feels like there were books that were kind of for us, but it wasn't a thing. Like I don't remember that as a category or anything like that. And it seems like with these books, the last two especially, based on what you've said, is that you're really getting to tell your story fully and finding an audience there. What's that like? Are you surprised by it? Or I was like, are there rules? How many F-bombs can you drop? Like, how does that world work?
So, I mean, I got into that world largely because my first book was an adult gay novel. It won the Lambda Literary Award for Best Debut. It was called The Walk-In Closet.
I have it right here. It's next.
Oh, you have it. Yeah. Oh, my God. One of 10 people who own it.
I actually got it from the library because I'm a girl on a budget. But
the library had it. Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. I wrote that book from the heart. I just wanted to tell a story about being gay in my culture. And it looked like I said, it got me a very prestigious award and I'm happy for that. I believe
Literary Award. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure, cause no one's refuted it. And I was told this by an academic that it is the first novel to have a gay male lead character, which is crazy. It came out in 2014. Gay male Iranian.
Yeah.
I don't know. The most important word, but that tells you how new things are in our community. And I remember like my literary agent at the time, who I absolutely love, told me I should keep writing books and I should pick a genre that was a little more commercial. He's like, don't just write like a gay adult novel. There's so few gay adults reading novels. And so I was kind of doing research into like thrillers and romance, and this and that. And at the time I have a cousin who's a teacher and she was really into what was happening in YA and young adult. And she was sending me books. And, you know, there were books being written, like a very well-known one that I absolutely love. It's called Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe.
Yeah, you know? And I just saw the film this year. It's really good.
Yeah, so it was produced by a good friend. So, you know, books like that, I was reading books like that. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is actually like a huge hit, this book. It's very culturally specific. It's very gay. It's, you know, I felt like maybe young adult was a world for me. And also I felt that so many of the stories I wanted to tell fit into young adult because I was still holding so many scars from my childhood, from being in the closet, from, you know, hiding who I was, from being an immigrant, all these stories. And so I just tried and the voice worked. I think as a writer, you sometimes know when you can capture a voice or when you can't. And I feel like for whatever reason, I can get back into the mindset of being a teenager. Like I'm able to go there. And it's been amazing. Like you would be surprised. Like people don't understand. Like my editor at Harper, at, you know, Balzer and Bray, which is an imprint at HarperCollins, like will often push me further than I think I can go. I mean, with Like a Love Story, the first draft did not have as many conversations about sex or sex scenes because, like, you're, you know, suggesting, I felt like I couldn't go there. I was like, well, I can hint at it, but I don't want to go too far. And it was really my amazing editor who said, you know, if you're going to write a story about growing up gay during the worst of this AIDS crisis, you have to deal with sex. Like, go there. Like, go to those scary places. And so a lot of the rewrite was me pushing myself further. And that was a really liberating thing. And then, you know, I wrote a book called The Chandler Legacies, which came out after Like a Love Story. And that one was very much inspired by my experience in boarding school, which was full of hazing and abuse. And, you know, there's been lots of news reports around schools like the one I went to. And again, like, I didn't shy away from it there. And I got to tell these really, to me, like, very mature stories that just happened to be for young people. And I think, you know, we forget that when we were teenagers, we were also grappling with the big issues of life. Like, teenagers are dealing with forming their identity and understanding the world in a way that's so fascinating.
If you had written Like a Love Story and it wasn't meant to be in the YA category, would it be that much different?
Probably not.
That's honestly what I was wondering. I was like, oh, well, he probably wanted to say cock here instead of skin or whatever, you know, like I was like, you know what? I don't feel like he's soft pedaling this very much.
No, I really don't think so. And look, YA to me is a category. It's a marketing category so that people can sell books, so that people know what books are appropriate for teenagers. From what I understand, the majority of readers of YA books are still adults. You know, many adults read them, whether it's because, you know, just like many adults watch high school movies like Mean Girls or whatever. Right. You know, it's always fun to revisit childhood. But, you know, people forget there was a Like a Love Story was one of the coolest things that happened for the book is it was on Time Magazine's list of 100 best young adult books of all time. And when I heard that first, I hadn't looked at the list. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's amazing. And I assumed all the books would be modern YA books. But it was alongside books like To Kill a Mockingbird and The Diary of Anne Frank and Little Women. And that's when I kind of realized, you know what? All YA is coming of age stories. It's just another word. It's another designation. It's a coming of age story. And if you like those, you know, if you're somebody who would want to read a book like To Kill a Mockingbird, which is about a child, you would also like this book. It just means a protagonist is a teenager.
I listened to the audio of Like a Love Story, and there was a point where I had to kind of stop and take a break because I was bummed out at what was coming. And here's what I knew was coming. The girl was going to get her heart broken. Mm-hmm. I could feel it because it's a bit of a love triangle between these two boys and this girl. And I feel like girls that got their heart broken by being in love with a gay guy that wasn't out yet, I feel like there should be a stamp for them. I feel like there should, you know, like there's Secretary's Day. I feel like there should be that day and we send a muffin basket. I had one.
It's like a Judy and Liza tattoo they all get.
Yeah, like, my heart breaks for them. Maybe it's guilt or whatever, but I was like, I can't listen. I need to take a break from this audio right now because I was like, this is not going to end well for Judy. But that's life.
But that is life. And I think in the end, it does end well for
Judy. It does. She gets there.
Those girls eventually forgive and find themselves and realize they were lucky to have that intense, beautiful relationship with a gay guy, even though it wasn't what they thought they wanted.
Right. But
it made life more special.
Yeah. But you wrote about it so vividly, and you go into the voice of each of the different characters. So you see everything through each person. And I was just like, oh.
It was fun. Well, in the audio, and this was really my request, I went to high school with Lauren Ambrose, the actress who, you know, most of your listeners probably know from 6 Feet Under, which masterpiece TV show. But she was very much like my, you know, one of my closest friends in high school. And when we were doing the audio, I called her and I'm like, look, like for you to read this character, given that it's about like the emotions we were going through at that age would be so special. And she said yes. And so listening to that, it's so meaningful for me personally to have one of my best friends from my teen years reading that.
Yeah. You're obsessed with old Hollywood. It's in both books.
Obsessed.
And how did you get obsessed with it?
I mean, this is so strange. I have to say, I think partially it was probably Madonna, because by the time I got obsessed with old Hollywood at the age of 10. By that age, I was very obsessed with Madonna. I'd seen the Virgin Tour. We moved to the US when I was 10.
Where did you move to?
So we moved to the suburbs of New York, to Scarsdale and Westchester. And we moved from Toronto. And in Toronto, I lived in an apartment building with a lot of Iranian cousins and friends. And then other cousins were in the building, apartment building next door. And I was so happy there because I was surrounded by the people who understood me, culturally. And when we moved to the suburbs of New York, it was just us. None of my cousins were with me. I really didn't fit in. I felt, you know, it was very hard to move to the United States without my cousins who got me. And so I would just come home from school and hide in my room. And one day my parents didn't have a lot of VHSs, but they had one VHS of the worst Marilyn Monroe movie called Let's Make Love. And I
did a deep dive in Marilyn a few years ago for a podcast project. Yeah. Watched Let's Make Love. Don't hate it.
Really?
I mean,
the musical numbers are genius.
I like the conceit of it too. I like the, because all of the writing about it is it's the worst. I didn't hate it. So there's that.
I mean, what makes me laugh about it is first of all, why did my parents own it? I've asked them about it and they said, we don't know. But also, so I watched it and I think probably I was curious to watch it because of Madonna, because at that point she'd referenced Marilyn Material Girl. But I just became completely obsessed with Marilyn Monroe. I remember my mom driving me to the video store and just going home with renting every Marilyn movie. Yeah. And, you know, within a week, I've deep dived in Marilyn, and then I'm I need more. And so I go to the video store for more old movies. And I think the next one I got obsessed with was Rita Hayworth, who I was a real, when I was young, I was deep in Rita Hayworth land.
Put the blame on Mame.
And, I mean, Gilda remains one of my top five movies of all time. But, you know, it just became a true obsession. I would tape TNT back then was what TCM is now, but they had commercials, and I would tape movies when I was at school, and then I would come home and watch the movies I taped, and I would organize them. I mean, this is so wild to think back. I was 10 when this all started. I would organize everything I taped alphabetically by female movie star, Bacall, Dietrich.
Oh, so good.
I mean, madness. And then there was this magazine back then called Hollywood Studio Magazine that I wish was still around, which was all about old Hollywood. And in the back of Hollywood Studio Magazine, there were these ads, because a lot of stuff wasn't available. Just like now, there still isn't stuff available. But, you know, I remember I was such a completist. I was I have to watch every Dietrich movie, you know, and this is one, The Devil is a Woman was impossible to find back then. You couldn't see it. And, you know, there were these ads back then of and you could write to people. I was 11 years old, writing to people from the back of this being do you have a copy of The Devil Is a Woman? Or do you have a copy of Letty Linton, which I still haven't seen. I need to get my hands on
Letty Linton. Would people send you things?
Yeah. Well, you just have to buy them. And I would send them. And I got, what else did I do? Oh my God. I wrote fan letters. I got responses. I got responses from Jimmy Stewart.
Okay.
Doris Day.
Nice. That tracks.
I mean, well, yeah. Yes. But I was a nut. You know, it baffles me when I think back to it, because there was no internet. I wasn't learning it because I knew it was gay culture. There's actually a book I'm really fascinated by called How to Be Gay. And a lot of it is about this gay code that a lot of us find that we don't even realize is gay. And it uses Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce as a particular touchstone. But I think I remember when I saw my first Joan Crawford movie, it felt the same way as seeing the Lucky Star video, which is what made me fall in love with Madonna. I think back to the Lucky Star video, there wasn't anything that gay about it. I mean, it's just Madonna dancing with two guys. But something in me knew, I knew something about her and about myself when I saw that video. It changed me forever.
Yeah. I remember there was a TV movie called The Girl Most Likely To with Stockard Channing.
Oh, sure.
Where, you know, Joan Rivers directed it, and it's kind of a black comedy and she gets revenge. I remember seeing that and being able to recount it plot point for plot point to friends. And I think that was one of those things that I don't think straight guys are after the ball game at Dairy Queen going, "You guys, I saw this movie last night, was this woman named Stalker Channing, and here's what..." I just don't think they're doing that.
But, well, but you know what's so funny is that I got, when I went to boarding school, I was so obsessed with Mommy Dearest. We were laughing about Mommy Dearest when I was like 11 years old. I understood it as a comedy. And by the way, our daughter doesn't, but our son understood it as a comedy when he was like 10 too.
Right.
Because we quoted and he wanted to watch it. But when I was in high school, I got the entire school obsessed with Mommy Dearest. I had a like boarding school Mommy Dearest party. People showed up with like wire hanger marks on their bodies and like in full costume. And then the best, I feel like your listeners will appreciate the story. I was a senior at the time at a very like, you know, New England fancy boarding school. I have this huge Mommy Dearest party. It's like epic and everyone's talking about it at school because it's not exactly what people normally do at a New England boarding school. And the next day, I think she was a freshman, this girl I'd never seen before, comes up to me and she's like, "My godmother is Faye Dunaway. You have to write her a letter about this. Like, she's going to love this." So I write Faye Dunaway the most epic letter. It's many pages long. I burned the edges so that the paper was all like, I mean, I was so dramatic. I was so like such an emo kid. I bought all the original Mommy Dearest lobby cards. I wrap it all in this old, I bought these like old Hollywood calendars. I wrapped it all in this like, and I sent it home to Los Angeles to spring break with this freshman.
I'm worried about this because she doesn't like to talk about it.
You shouldn't be worried.
You could be triggering. You shouldn't be worried. Oh, I'm so scared of where this story is going to go.
She came back from spring break and I was hoping she was going to like autograph all the
right.
And I'm like, "How did it go?" And she's like, Faye commented on how beautiful the wrapping was. And then she like opened your letter. She's like, "This is so gorgeous." And then she started reading it and she said she threw it or ripped it or threw it.
Oh my God.
And said, "Never talk to me about that movie again."
I knew that might be where it was going. I'd heard tell.
And I will say, as obsessed as I was with Faye Dunaway and Mommy Dearest before that happened, after that happened, it was like deep obsession. I love her so much.
Yeah, that's almost like, what you want. It's almost what you want.
It's exactly what you... And that's the thing that is so funny. It's like I've met all these celebrities who are so lovely to me. And like the one I'm obsessed with is the one who ripped up my fan letter.
Yeah. Well, you almost want Madonna to be a little bratty to you. Maybe not current Madonna, but there was an era where that was kind of her thing.
Do you want my almost met Madonna story?
Sure.
Your listeners will like this one too. So when I was 13 years old, I lived in France when I was from between the age of 2 and 7, and my grandmother stayed in the south of France her whole life. So we would spend the summers there. And one summer, we were there during the whole Blonde Ambition tour in the south of France, which is where they were filming Truth or Dare, where they filmed the HBO special.
Right. Live in Nice. The ringlets, live, not the ponytail.
I was 13 years old. I was in the closet. We didn't even know. I had seen the Blonde Ambition tour in New York at this point. Still didn't quite piece together that like all the dancers were gay. We hadn't seen
it except there Oliver.
Yet. Well, yeah, except Oliver. All of our... The Persian girls were in love with Slam.
Yeah, like, I was in love with Slam.
It was great. I mean, I was in love with Slam. And in any case, turned out the hotel we were staying at was not where Madonna was put up, but where the crew and the dancers were put up. So they were all there. Nikki, Donna, the dancers, the crew members. We were going crazy. Like Jose and Luis and all those guys were like dancing in their underwear in the lobby. And I mean, it was the 13-year-old's dream. But Madonna wasn't there. And then one day I'm in my hotel room and my friend like bangs on the door and is like, "Madonna's in the lobby. You got to run." And literally like, I'm in my boxers. I grab my camera. I run down. And by the time I get there, she's leaving and she's like going to the dock. There's crowds and security and it's the peak of her fame. And I fucking run. I have these photos of her that I actually posted on Instagram that like from a day no one's ever seen photos of. And anyway, but the best part of the story is that for the like 2 seconds Madonna was in the lobby, she sat next to my aunt who could give a shit about Madonna. And my aunt turns to her and she says, "Are you Madonna?" And Madonna's response was, "I wish I was Madonna. She's so beautiful and talented and popular. She's a superstar." And then she puts on her sunglasses and walks out. And that's when I'm like running. And that story's kind of like become myth in our family, because again, it's exactly what you want Madonna to be. Like the fact that she said that, it's like if someone says, "Are you Madonna?"
Yeah.
That's exactly what you want her to say.
Well, I've talked before on this podcast about how my writing career began because I auditioned for her as a dancer and wrote a story about it, and it got my first publishing thing, right. And it grew from there. But I got to interview her years later as part of a roundtable for Bedtime Stories. And one of the questions I asked her, I told her that I had a writing career because she rejected me as a dancer. And she goes, well, you took a negative and you made it a positive. And I was like, thank you. That's something you would do. And then I asked her if she could be anonymous for a day, what she would do and where she would go.
Ooh,
what do you think she said? It's something we talked about on this podcast already in a way.
Like that she would go like to the movies or to a museum and just like see art without people.
That would be it. She would go dancing. She would go to a nightclub and go dancing. Yeah. Tear some shit up on the floor. Yeah.
She can still do that. I mean, I don't want, maybe she can. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, do you want to read a little bit about the Blonde Ambition section before we wrap it up? Okay. This is in Like a Love Story. The three friends who had a lot of tensions between them because there was love triangle stuff going on are now together at the Blonde Ambition tour. Oh, and there's one other thing I want to mention before this. The character of Steven, who is the uncle with AIDS, he has an issue with the song Vogue, and I never thought about it until I read it in there, and now I can't stop thinking about it. So do you want to say what that is before you read the segment?
It's what the hell is Joe DiMaggio doing in the song?
Yes, because it's all sort of glamorous Hollywood people.
My personal take on it is that in ballroom, they would have the like butch segment. Well, and so that's what it was.
Yeah.
I always just feel like, and
it's a melodic name though. It sounds good to say.
It does sound good. And he was with Marilyn, so he's connected that way. I do feel like, you know, Joan and Judy not being in the song is kind of rude, but I also think she made The Power of Goodbye as like a I'm sorry to Joan Crawford. Cause you know, The Power of Goodbye video is parts of it are a shot for shot remake of my favorite Joan Crawford movie, Humoresque.
I did not know that. That's good to know. I did not know that.
Does that mean you've never seen Humoresque?
I've never seen Humoresque. Are we going to have a night? Are we going to watch it?
You're going to actually lose your mind.
Okay.
Humoresque, it's like that movie is just so divine. It is like the Joan Crawford movie. She actually doesn't have the biggest role in it. John Garfield is the lead. He's like a really talented violin virtuoso, and she's like the rich alcoholic who is his patron.
Yeah.
And it's just like there's sequences in that movie that are nothing but close-ups of Joan Crawford watching him play violin. I mean, it's just like a whole sequence of watching Joan, like in her glasses, taking her glasses on and off, like watching him play Tchaikovsky. And you're like, what is this?
Yeah.
But the big crescendo of that movie is Joan. I'm going to give it all. I'm sorry. Whatever. It's Joan on the beach at the end. And that whole sequence in The Power of Goodbye on the beach is I mean, there you could see on YouTube. It is shot for shot.
Oh, I love it. All right. I'm edified. I need to look that up.
I also love Madonna as a student of, I love what Madonna references.
Yeah.
I love like when she takes movies like Metropolis or Humoresque or this, or, you know, you don't even, she's such a student of art. She like.
Well, even the Marilyn homage at the Sooner or Later Oscars with those movements and the fur flying and the.
I can't. The Sooner or Later was. I still get chills. Do you remember how nervous?
She was so nervous, her hands were shaking. I interviewed Vincent Patterson for this.
I was so nervous.
Podcast talking about it.
Vincent? You did? You interviewed him?
Yeah, it was a two-parter like yours because we go deep. That's I'll send you the link.
And me. That is so cool.
Yeah. I also interviewed a guy named A. Ashley Huff who wrote a book about The Match Game, but guess what his next book is about?
What?
Mommy Dearest. And it comes out soon, and he needs your story in it because it's too good. I'm going to try to connect you. It may be too late.
Okay, try and connect
for the paperback.
It's like a behind the scenes.
I think so. Yeah, and his Match Game book was no joke. It was thick and it had all everything you would want. Yeah.
One of the coolest events I went to, I'm sure he'll write about it, was on the 25th anniversary of Mommy Dearest at Town Hall in New York City. They had this event where they screened the movie with Christina Crawford in the audience as all the gay men. Every gay man in the audience is like saying every line out loud. And then afterwards, Rex Reed and Lipsynka recreated Joan's last interview there in that same spot. And Lipsynked every word of the fucking interview.
What an amazing event. Oh my gosh.
It was, and as part of the event, Christina was there. But as part of the event, Rutanya Alda, who played Carol Ann, she read her journals from the set, which were all about how awful Faye was.
Oh.
It was I mean, it was the most amazing night. Yeah. The most.
Faye Dunaway kept me waiting longer than any other interview subject in my career. Although once we sat down at the Ivy, she was okay. She was good.
But to interview Faye Dunaway at the Ivy?
I did. Yeah.
Before. I mean, your life is.
Yeah.
Cool. You got a pretty cool life.
Well, I'm still here. So as Madonna says in her concert, when she talks about just like, we're still here. I got, you know, there's something about that. Just being That's there right. that is, I found incredibly
down
powerful.
All, around.
All right. Read a little bit about Blonde Ambition from the book Like a Love Story.
Okay. The lights dim, and in an instant, the crowd goes wild. No one more than me. We scream in unison like a tsunami of sound that we are sending over to the stage, which practically vibrates with energy like a mating call. We are calling our goddess to us. Lights flash. An electronic beat begins. An industrial stage is revealed. Male dancers with sculpted bodies appear on stage, chains around them. And then she is in front of us, singing Express Yourself. No, she's in front of me, because there's no one else in this room but me and Madonna. I cannot take my eyes off of her for the first half of the song. But midway through, Judy bumps into me. She dances, feels the energy, and we look at each other, both singing along. A moment passes between us. Maybe she, like me, remembers wearing that Express Yourself lingerie and how horribly that turned out for us. By the time the next song, Open Your Heart, begins, I can feel something in Judy thawing, like the song is literally opening her heart. Judy smiles at me, a smile of forgiveness and empathy, a smile full of history. Here in this stadium, we are dancing, we are singing, we are forgiven, we are glowing, we are understood. I glance at Mrs. Bowman a few times during the show. She watches with fascination, but with no sense of connection. When Madonna masturbates during Like a Virgin, she covers her eyes with her hands and yells, "Oh no, this is too much." "It certainly is too much," Jimmy says with glee, "and that's why I love it." But the show takes a turn when Madonna sings Like a Prayer. She begins the song by simply looking up at the heavens and calling out, "God?" She speaks God as a question, like she's wondering where he has gone, how he's letting this world burn. The show goes from something fun to something challenging. After Like a Prayer, she sings Live to Tell, and at that point, the audience is in a hush. I hear a sob, and I turn to see it's Mrs. Bowman, tears flowing down her usually composed face. One by one, we all turn to Mrs. Bowman, shocked to see her crying. Judy holds out her hand, and her mother takes it, squeezes it hard. Judy cries too now, and soon I do too, and Art. "Oh God," Mrs. Bowman says, still clutching Judy's hand. She rests her head on Jimmy's shoulder, her tears moistening the velvet of the jacket. He comforts her. It's hard to hear her words over the music, but I think she says, "He won't live, will he? He won't live to tell anything." "Shh, baby, it's okay," Jimmy says. "Cry it out." And she does. I do too, because I am so filled with emotion, so much love. For Madonna, for the dreams she allows me to dream through her magnificence. For Art, whose hand I'm clutching so tight, who I can't get enough of. For Judy, my first friend. For Jimmy, who I once feared touching. For Mrs. Bowman, who is so kind. And yet, there's still fear. Fear that Stephen and Jimmy will be gone soon. Fear that all these beautiful dancers on stage with Madonna will be gone soon. Fear that this celebratory holiday we are experiencing will end. Fear that just as my life is beginning, it will come to a violent stop. Will it grow cold, the secret that I hide? I feel it all in the 2 hours that Madonna graces us with her presence. Joy and pride and love and fear and anger and passion. And one emotion I never thought I would feel. Fate. Yes, fate. Because if the world could bring together this woman with these songs and these dancers in this place with me in it, then creation must be more powerful than destruction. I'll stop there.
Oh my gosh. Just to clarify, Mrs. Bowman is the sister of Stephen, the character that has AIDS and may not have much longer when this scene is taking place. Beautiful, beautiful. And it just sort of, and then to be in this moment where we almost lost her and, we didn't.
I know. And I didn't even think about this, but I haven't reread that passage in so long. Because like I said, I don't reread my books, but it's almost eerie to think of the sequence in the celebration tour that goes from Holiday to Like a Prayer to Live to Tell. Cause yeah. those are the, the idea that the holiday is ending and Like a Prayer to Live to Tell. It's so, it just goes to show also, I think for all of her reinventions, Madonna has stayed so true to her core self and her core values. And she's still, yeah. she's still bringing that same message to us.
Tell people how they can find your books and find you.
They can find the books wherever books are sold or hopefully at your local library. But, you know, I love supporting a local bookstore if you can. And they can find me at Instagram. I'm Abdaddy. I'm also Abdaddy on Twitter. And I have a website.
And what's your website?
Abdinazemian.com.
Abdi, I'm looking at my list. I have so many more questions for you. So do you mind if we do this as a two-part interview and this will be the end of part one?
I would be honored to be a two-parter.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. That was part one of my interview with Abdi Nazemian. Tune in next week for part two. Lots of more fun, interesting, moving conversations. And maybe I cry. I don't know. I cry all the time now, as it turns out. And I might even cry in this story that I'm going to tell you now. And for so this happened. So I got to do some interviews on the set of the show 9-1-1 recently. Short interviews, but one of the people I got to interview was Jennifer Love Hewitt. And I interviewed her back in the day when I was writing for magazines multiple times. I know I profiled her for Movie Line. I did the cover story for her, for Detour with her. I did a cover story with Sky Magazine with her. Like, we had a thing going for a while. And so I didn't know if she would remember me. It's been 25 years, probably at least. And she did remember me. And she was very warm about it. She's like, I know you. We've known each other forever. And she gave me a hug. And it was a sweet moment. And while they were setting up the lights, I said, I remember we went to Universal Studios together. We went on rides as part of the story. Not a lot of actors would do that. She goes, well, not a lot of them are as big a dorks as I was. And then there was a moment while they were adjusting a light or something where she was just kind of looking at me and she goes, we're still here. And I found that so moving for some reason. I think it's because I'm at a place where I'm questioning my choices, where I am like, can I still make a living doing this stuff? Do I need to switch gears? I don't have any regrets, but I am a little bit like, what am I doing? This isn't a sustainable life. And it's not just me. It's in the air. And it's not even a sad thing. It's just a very raw thing, I think, which you've probably picked up on if you've listened to this podcast a bit. It should be called Cry for Help with Dennis Hensley. But anyway, there was something very moving about her saying that to me. And because I think it's not easy to be a person in the world generally, but also kind of pursuing things that are unpredictable and difficult, but it can be really great sometimes. So anyway, thanks to people call her Love, her friends call her Love. Thanks for Love for that little moment of something that was really meaningful to me. All right, that's enough talking for this week. My mouth is barely moving anymore. I want to give a shout out to Oscar Rosario for mixing the episodes. My theme music is by Mark Danels for Placement Music. I also want to get a plug in for the Mismatch game happening in Palm Springs on Friday the 15th at Oscars Palm Springs. You can learn about that at the Oscars website. Hope to see you there. And we'll catch you next time on Dennis Anyone. Bye.